From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The enemies of peace realize they cannot defeat us with traditional military means. So they are working on two new forms of assault, which you've heard about today. Cyber attacks on our critical computer systems, and attacks with weapons of mass destruction, chemical, biological, potentially even nuclear weapons.
Warning of likely biological, chemical, or cybernetic terrorist attacks on U.S. soil. President Clinton proposes new anti-terrorism measures. We'll talk with foreign reporters on impeachment and a look at Raul Salinas' prison sentence of 50 years. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Iraq claims several people have died in two U.S. missile attacks in and around the city of Basra. According to some reports, the attacks hit a residential neighborhood in the city. Officials also report dozens of people wounded. A Pentagon spokesman says only that there were airstrikes today, which he calls a result of provocation. Basra is located in southern Iraq, close to the border with Kuwait. During the so-called Gulf War, Basra was hit with thousands of tons of bombs, and U.S. and British troops fired off more than 1 million depleted uranium-tipped bullets, which has led to an increase in birth defects and illnesses. Back on Capitol Hill, President Clinton's impeachment trial could reach a turning point today. Senators face debate on two crucial issues that could lead to the end of the trial or prolong it indefinitely. The Senate's foremost keeper of its traditions, Democrat Robert Byrd of West Virginia, is expected to move to dismiss the case against the president. Then there's the question of whether there will be witnesses. White House lawyers and House prosecutors will each have an hour to speak on dismissal. Senators then may debate the issue, either in open or closed session. That's still up for debate. Then senators would take up the question of witnesses before voting on either motion. Also today, House prosecutors are expected to make public their proposed list of witnesses. It's likely to include Monica Lewinsky, Vernon Jordan, and Betty Curry. House managers interviewed Lewinsky yesterday in Washington. The military released 1,145 gay men and lesbians in 1998, the most in 11 years. Gay rights advocates say commanders investigate sexual orientation. The Pentagon says people are speaking up to avoid service. President Clinton is touting a new drop in welfare caseloads, even as he urges greater efforts to find jobs for ex-recipients. At a White House ceremony today, the president is set to announce that the number of Americans on welfare has dropped to its lowest in 30 years. Aides say Clinton will use the occasion to unveil new welfare-to-work initiatives. Yesterday, Clinton returned home to Arkansas to view tornado damage. The visit included walks through a pair of Little Rock neighborhoods and a visit to Beebe, northeast of the Capitol. In Beebe, a familiar face was spotted in the crowd, Paula Jones. Her sex harassment case against Clinton was settled with a check earlier this month. She told reporters she was interested in storm relief efforts. The president only learned of her presence afterwards. America's envoy to Kosovo is heading back there to try to jumpstart negotiations. Christopher Hill plans to meet with ethnic Albanian leaders about a deal to end the trouble with the Serbs. Hill's last four proposals for autonomy have been shot down by both sides. But after this month's massacre of 45 ethnic Albanians, there's extra pressure to end the conflict. Just in case it doesn't end, NATO ambassadors will meet today in Brussels to work out a plan that threatens airstrikes while searching for a diplomatic solution. Also today in Brussels, European Union ministers are looking at ways to bring a peaceful end to the Kosovo troubles. This news from Texas. The prosecutor in the high-profile murder case in Jasper, Texas, says people are afraid to show up for jury duty. Jury selection begins today in the first of three murder trials in the dragging death of a black man in Texas. The county district attorney says only about half of the randomly selected 400 residents are likely to show up today for selection. He says many people have told him they're reluctant to serve because of the media attention the case has received. He says they don't want to have their picture taken or be interviewed. Three white men are accused of chaining James Byrd Jr. to the back of a pickup truck 9 months ago and dragging his body until his head came off. Pen and notebook in hand, the white mustachioed elder in the safari jacket interviewing the tall female gorilla in Colombia was no average reporter, yet Nobel laureate Gabriel Garcia Marquez, scribbling notes at this month's peace talks between the Colombian government and leftist rebels, was merely doing what comes naturally. At age 71, Gabriel Garcia Marquez has returned to frontline reporting to fulfill a lifelong dream. The novelist has just bought a struggling weekly newspaper, Cambio, which has a cadre of some of Colombia's finest journalists. He was asked to be a mediator between the guerrillas and government. He turned that down. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman.
The enemies of peace realize they cannot defeat us with traditional military means. So they are working on two new forms of assault, which you've heard about today. Cyber attacks on our critical computer systems and attacks with weapons of mass destruction, chemical, biological, potentially even nuclear weapons. We must be ready.
In announcing new anti-terrorism initiatives, President Clinton on Friday warned it's highly likely a terrorist group will launch a biological, chemical, or cybernetic attack on the continental United States in the next few years. Saying he'd been persuaded by intelligence reports, the president said he was considering a proposal from the Defense Department to establish a commander-in-chief for the defense of the continental United States, a step that's met with concern by civil liberties defenders. The Pentagon has commanders overseeing regions around the globe, but its jurisdiction does not extend to the United States itself. Responding to questions on whether his measures could represent a loss of individual rights, Clinton insisted that such erosion would never occur and asked Americans to trust him on the issue. Many voiced skepticism that these assurances came from a president who approved the biggest expansion of the government's use of wiretapping contained in the Anti-Terrorism Act of 1996, but Clinton said the American people should trust him.
In all our battles, we will be aggressive. At the same time, I want you to know that we will remain committed to uphold privacy rights and other constitutional protections, as well as the proprietary rights of American businesses. It is essential that we do not undermine liberty in the name of liberty.
That President Clinton speaking on Friday at the National Academy of Sciences, announcing a new initiative against terrorism. This in the midst of the Senate impeachment trial, some raising questions if President Clinton isn't dealing with issues of the military increasing the budget to saying he wants an increase in the budget of $110 billion, increasing Star Wars by $6 billion, and now bringing up the issue of terrorism to increase the stakes, saying that perhaps if he was removed from office, this would be a threat to national security. We're joined right now by David Cole, professor of Georgetown University Law Center and a legal affairs correspondent for The Nation. Leonard Cole also joins us, author of The 11th Plague, The Politics of Biological and Chemical Warfare. David Cole, what are your concerns about the new anti-terrorism initiatives that President Clinton proposed on Friday?
Well, I'd say my concerns are somewhat limited. That is, a lot of what he's proposed I don't find problematic. The kind of technological and medical responses to attempt to get us prepared in the event of some sort of a biological or a chemical warfare, they seem perfectly appropriate and certainly don't raise civil liberties concerns. Things like developing new vaccines, stockpiling antibiotics, having emergency medical teams to respond in major cities, that kind of thing I think is I don't really have a way of assessing how necessary it is, but it seems certainly doesn't raise constitutional civil liberties concerns. But I think this notion, much more vague in his proposal, that we get the military involved in domestic law enforcement raises very serious sort of broad concerns about civil liberties, because the experience of the world is that when the military gets involved in domestic law enforcement, civil rights and civil liberties go by the wayside. And we have had a long tradition in this country of separating out domestic law enforcement from the military, precisely because of concerns about overreaching by the military. The military is not in the business of paying respect to civil liberties and civil rights. They're in the business of engaging in wartime activities, and so they have very little sensibility to those kinds of concerns, and they also have incredible power. And once that power can be focused on domestic activity, all of our rights would be seriously threatened.
Professor Cole, can you explain what posse comitatus is?
Posse comitatus is a notion that we should not be using the military to do domestic law enforcement, that we should have a separate police force which is not empowered to engage in war, is empowered to engage in domestic law enforcement, and we should have a military which, by contrast, is focused on international efforts and not on domestic efforts.
Mm-hmm. We're also joined by Leonard Cole, author of The 11th Plague, The Politics of Biological and Chemical Warfare. He's an adjunct professor of political science at Rutgers University in Newark, New Jersey. What are your thoughts in response to President Clinton saying that the United States could well be attacked in the next few years by terrorists using biological or chemical or cybernetic approaches?
Well, in the area of biological and chemical warfare, which is really my area of expertise, rather than the cyber questions, I would say this is part of a larger construct that has me concerned. That is, during the past couple of years, we've seen a momentum that has almost a self-perpetuation about what some have already suggested is the quote-unquote inevitability of such an attack, and I do not buy that. Surely the risks are there. They're greater than they had been previously for a range of political and diplomatic and, in some cases, military reasons. But I am concerned that we have had more of a drumbeat about this whole issue, and that the emphasis that we're hearing out of Washington on the need to prepare almost has a self-fulfilling prophecy aspect to it. It gives people a lot of ideas who otherwise would not be thinking about a biological or a chemical weapon, whether it be a terrorist or an organized group or even a state or a country itself.
But Professor Leonard Cole, if you look at just the last year, what the United States has done, the bombing of Sudan, the bombing of Afghanistan, just in the last 24 hours, the bombing of Iraq, possibly a neighborhood in Basra, killing a number of people, wouldn't that up the ante of a possible retaliatory attack?
Well, it conceivably could, but I'd like to look at the larger picture of what is in it for the terrorist or the individual or whoever who wishes to use a chemical or a biological agent as a weapon. There have been something like a dozen false alarms of anthrax attacks, pseudo attacks that never took place in California during the past 4 months, in which, in each case, hundreds and hundreds of people were evacuated from buildings, some held in quarantine. In one case, people were stripped for 4 hours and took up showers and baths, ostensibly to protect themselves against an anthrax attack. So far, the truth is that in the past 2 years, we've had far more trauma from anxiety, terror, and fear than by any use of any such weapon.
Are you concerned about President Clinton saying he's considering weighing a proposal to give anthrax vaccinations to police, fire, public health, and other emergency officials in cities throughout the country? In an interview he did with the New York Times to hype the talk he was about to give on Friday, he refused to say whether he himself had been vaccinated against deadly germ agents.
Yes, I noticed that. That raises a host of questions. First, if a person were sophisticated enough to develop an anthrax weapon that could then be used and dispersed in an effective way, what does that mean for the rest of the population that isn't vaccinated? And if a person who would have that sophistication knew that a population were vaccinated against anthrax, There are dozens and dozens of other organisms that can cause serious illness, disease, sometimes death. And it would be, I would think, just a minimum basis of reason for the person to suggest, to think to himself, I'll develop something against this population by way of plague or Ebola or something else other than anthrax. Surely anthrax is, as they say, among the most popular of the weapons because it's relatively easy to develop and grow, and it's very effective, but it is certainly not the only biological agent. And the more we focus on the narrow notion that if you develop a certain number of vaccines for a certain number of agents, there we should feel quite protected, you are avoiding, or you're actually in denial about the possibility of using alternative biological agents.
Doesn't it also raise concerns, though, about the health of the people who are forced to be vaccinated? I mean, there have been questions about whether the thousands of Persian Gulf vets who got sick and suffer from Persian Gulf War syndrome, possibly a contributor to that, are the fact that they had to take these FDA non-approved vaccinations.
Well, you're raising another interesting point. You know, the whole business of Gulf War syndrome, the 700,000 veterans of the Gulf War who have felt that they were made ill by one exposure or another, not knowing exactly which, whether it was an actual chemical agent or in some cases possibly the vaccine. 150,000 of the troops who were in the Gulf Theater did receive at least one vaccination against anthrax. And it has to be understood that while the vaccine against anthrax has been around for maybe 30 years, it has hardly been used because it is a very, very rare disease as it, in terms of affecting people. It does affect livestock. So there have been a minimal number of people who have received the vaccination, and it's not quite clear whether it would be very effective against inhalation spores, that is, lots and lots of thousands of spores that you'd be breathing in, nor is it very clear what the side effects would be long-term for a large number of people. The 150,000 people who did receive the vaccination during the Gulf War, when there was an effort to revisit their health, the Institute of Medicine, which is part of the National Academy of Sciences, tried to review the records, found that the records were so botched that they didn't even know who got the vaccines when and were unable to follow their medical history. So we have lost a serious opportunity for studying the efficacy or at least the safety of the vaccine.
Professor Leonard Cole, author of 11th Plague, and Professor David Cole from Georgetown University Law Center were also joined by Jamie Love, director of the Consumer Project on Technology, which is a nonprofit which works on information policy, electronic commerce, and intellectual property rights. President Clinton talked about a possible biological, chemical, or cybernetic attack. What is your response to the cybernetic aspect, Jamie Love? Jamie Love, are you there? I guess we don't have you on. Let me go back to Professor Leonard Cole on the issue of...
Jamie?
No, this is David Cole.
Sorry. On the issue of Professor... On the issue of the scenarios that the U.S. is dealing with. You wrote a book, in The 11th Plague and other books you've written. You talk about experiments that the U.S. government engaged in during the 40 years of the Cold War, which, to say the least, were very frightening. For example, the dropping of black light bulbs filled with billions of, was it, viruses in the New York City subways by government agents. And this the U.S. government has admitted to. Are we going to see something? First, explain that. And do you think that we're going to see something like this again?
Yeah, well, before we get the idea that the government was actually attacking us with biological weapons, it should be clear that the bacteria that they put into the light bulbs were called simulants. The Army used something called Bacillus subtilis, which is a fairly common bacterium. And they said it was harmless, but that it would simulate, it would mimic the actions and dispersion and survivability of more potent spores or microorganisms like anthrax. What I did find, and I wrote about this extensively in an earlier book called Clouds of Secrecy, was that the medical literature existing at the time in the 1950s and 60s, when all these tests were taking place around the country, using Bacillus subtilis and other such organisms, that these organisms were not innocuous entirely, that with a large population of millions of people being exposed, and there were many millions of people who, without their knowledge or consent, were breathing in these organisms, that there was risk, that there was indication in the medical and scientific literature that people sometimes became ill, especially if they were in compromised health conditions, very old, very young, so that there was a danger, and the Army side kind of overlooked that. I just hope we don't return to that situation today, where we do a lot of testing on people who are unwitting subjects.
Well, Leonard Cole, author of The 11th Plague, and Professor David Cole of Georgetown University Law Center, I want to thank you both very much for being with us as we look at President Clinton's proposals against a terrorist attack in the United States. We come back, we'll speak for a few minutes to Jamie Love to deal with the possibility of a cybernetic attack and what are the approaches the government is taking to that. Then we're going to get Foreign Reporter's response to what's happening in Washington, the Senate impeachment trial, and finally take a look at Mexico, human rights abuses there, as well as what the sentencing of the brother of the former Mexican president, Raul Salinas, means for Mexico and the United States. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman as we finish up our discussion on President Clinton's, well, vague proposals on how to deal with a terrorist attack, biological, chemical, and cybernetic. Jamie Love on the phone with us, director of the Consumer Project on Technology. What was your response to President Clinton's speech at the National Academy of Sciences yesterday, Jamie Love, on Friday?
Well, I think that on the one hand, the president is responding to an anxiety people have about threats to the infrastructure that could be caused by intrusions in computers. And you're confronted, I think, on a frequent basis with examples of people hacking websites and disclosures of information that maybe shouldn't have happened, and just sort of a lot of bad security practices or sort of computer viruses. So I think it's People have direct evidence or a lot of information about these kind of activities. On the other hand, there's, I think, a big sense of unease that the Clinton administration has been a colossal disappointment when it comes to the issues about privacy or civil rights. And it's ironic in a way that his current predicament is one of a failure to have the government, I guess, set limits on how far they can go in terms of intrusions of privacy. He's a victim, I guess, of a lack of civil rights and a lack of privacy. And yet, every opportunity he's had to have important initiatives in that area have never surfaced. Mm-hmm.
What are you most concerned about when it comes to the government dealing with a cybernetic attack? I mean, in terms of civil liberties and people's privacy on their computers.
Well, if you look at the activities that are sometimes proposed by the government, and I, there's a range of things the government's involved in that has to do with trying to build in certain types of private government partnerships in terms of computer security systems that I think are troubling to a lot of people. A lot of times these initiatives are excuses for much broader government initiatives in the area of surveillance and wiretapping, and they pose special problems in terms of the internet. And the internet, the ability to scan information, to sort of have massive archives of information, relate to political discussions and dialogue, personal communications, business transactions, and everything is really quite massive. And so, if the architecture of the infrastructure itself is designed in such a way so that it's easy for our government to penetrate it, under the theory that they're being used to ward off certain cyber attacks. It poses all sorts of civil liberties risks, not only, of course, in the United States, but throughout the world.
And so what are you attempting to do about this, your center?
I think that the groups that have really been the most active in this have been groups like EPIC, the Electronic Privacy Information Center. And they have they issued a report just recently on the in 1998 on this initiative that the president was talking about recently, the critical infrastructure protection initiative that the president's involved in. Now, a lot of the areas that they're involved in are trying to erect clear distinctions between the government and the private sector. If you go back and look at some of the history of this, you've had initiatives where, for example, the government would approach Lexis, which is a company that provides online searching of articles about newspaper articles or a variety of research materials, and they'd ask them to systematically provide the government with the names of people that were searching for certain keywords or certain things that the government proposed as a risk. And you also see the case of the government engaged in activity to identify hostile websites or inappropriate or politically unfavorable information from certain dissident groups in countries that are opposing regimes that are supported by the United States. And this takes place in, I don't know, everyone from Sri Lanka to China to Mexico, really throughout the world. I'll just sort of maybe mention one thing.
We just have about 30 seconds.
Okay. I think that the world is a dangerous place, and the Internet presents a lot of important issues, but this president needs to really begin a much better dialogue on the concrete steps the government has to undertake in order to create real protections of privacy and real civil rights in an area where the technology is so ubiquitous in terms of the kinds of communications that we undertake.
Well, Jamie Love, I want to thank you very much for being with us. How can people get in touch with the Consumer Project on Technology?
Our website is www.cptech.org. That's cptech.org. And I think for information on this particular initiative, they would probably be a good idea also to check with EPIC, which is on the web at www.epic.org.
Well, thanks for being with us, Jamie Love, Director of the Consumer Project on Technology, a nonprofit group which works on information policy, electronic commerce, and intellectual property rights issues. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now! House prosecutors interviewed Monica Lewinsky yesterday at the Mayflower Hotel in Washington, D.C. as part of a last-ditch effort to persuade the Senate to call witnesses at President Clinton's trial. Well, they emerged from the encounter saying that Lewinsky could add valuable testimony to the trial. Her lawyer joined Democrats in insisting that after 22 appearances before the grand jury, the special prosecutor and others, Lewinsky had nothing new to add to the case against the president. The New York Times quoted her as telling a friend, "I gave them nothing." Well, I was on the Hill on Saturday during the Senate impeachment trial, talking to senators as they came in and out of the Senate chamber, and they were, at least Democrats, furious that the House prosecutors had managed, through independent prosecutor Kenneth Starr, to get a federal judge, Norma Holloway Johnson, to allow the House prosecutors to speak to Monica Lewinsky. They said that it was a shortcutting the Senate process. Iowa Democrat Tom Harkin sent a letter to William Rehnquist saying that there are three separate branches of government, the executive, the judicial, and the legislative, and that judiciary in this case had no right to supersede the Senate, the legislative, which is the supreme body when it comes to an impeachment, the decision whether to remove a president. I had a chance to speak with Senator John Breaux of Louisiana about how he felt.
Well, I think it really is an unnecessary position for them to take. I really think that it's sort of like a Hail Mary pass in the last minutes of the game. It's not going to give them any information that they don't have already, and while legally they may be able to do it, I doubt whether it's going to give them any information. And I do feel the possibility of intimidation is there. I mean, if she's going to be in a room locked in with the independent counsel asking her what she's going to say right before she's called, if she may or may not be called, I think that's I think it's inappropriate.
And what about, will there be a debate on a vote to dismiss? At this point, we understand it'll either be behind closed doors or there will be no debate, just the White House counsel and the House prosecutors debating, and then the senators simply voting up or down.
Well, I mean, if the Senate can find time to debate water projects and highway projects, we certainly ought to have the time to debate one of the most important issues that we'll ever face probably in history, and that is the impeachment and possible conviction of the President of the United States. I think it would be wrong for us to have to make a decision and vote without having any debate whatsoever by our colleagues.
What will ultimately decide this question?
Well, the Senate really will make the decision. I mean, if you have a majority of the votes, you can make a decision to not have debate. I think that that would be the wrong decision, and I would hope our colleagues would recognize that and turn that down and allow us to debate in private how we feel about this issue.
Senator Breaux, you're from the South. Are you calling on your colleague on the other side of the aisle, Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott, to denounce the Council of Conservative Citizens that he apparently has spoken before a number of times and has connections to, and to speak out on the issue?
Well, I have not discussed it with Trent. I mean, we have been involved in a lot of things. That's not one of the things that we have dealt with. We're spending most of our time right here in the Senate on the impeachment trial. I have not had a chance to talk with him about that. I don't have any plans to do so. I think he's made some comments about his position in that regard, and I think that he will speak for himself on that.
Louisiana Senator John Breaux, Democrat, and talking in that last question about the Council of Conservative Citizens and Trent Lott's connections to it. Interesting how senators can be fierce opponents on one story, the case of the impeachment of the president, but somehow come together on issues like the Council of Conservative Citizens. In fact, Trent Lott has not spoken directly to his involvement with the council, and we are still waiting his response on it. His denunciation, if he has one, of the council, his distancing himself from it, and what he was doing, speaking at their meetings, his articles appearing in their newsletter, the Citizens Informer. Well, on the issue of the Senate today, it's preparing to vote on two separate measures, one proposed by Senator John Byrd of West Virginia, Democrat, to dismiss the case against the president, another proposed by Republicans to call witnesses, to subpoena witnesses. Again, we still do not know at this point whether there will be an open debate by the senators on the issue. The House prosecutors and the White House counsel will be debating both issues, but the question is, will the senators get a chance to debate? Will they get a chance to debate in public or in private, if at all? We've been talking about this issue for quite a while now, and we thought we would go international and look at some foreign reporters' coverage of the Senate impeachment trial and the kind of issues they're concerned about. We're joined right now by Mary Dajewski, who is the Washington correspondent for The Independent of London. We're also joined in the studio by Dapo Olorunyomi, who is a reporter for Tempo and the News in Nigeria, and will be filing a column on this story. Paulo Sotero is joining us on the telephone. He's the Washington correspondent for O Estado de Sao Paulo, which is a Brazilian newspaper, and we welcome you all to Democracy Now! Let's begin with Mary Dajewski. What is the latest story you filed on the impeachment trial?
Well, the latest story that I filed last night was immediately after the representatives came out of the Mayflower Hotel, having apparently interrogated Monica Lewinsky for 2 hours. That caught our last editions in London and nicely rounded off the story for yesterday evening.
I was pretty stunned on one of the morning talk shows to hear one of the House prosecutors, when asked what they're going to ask Monica Lewinsky, he said how she felt about news reports that she was overweight. I'm not quite sure how that dealt with the weighty matter of impeachment, but were you at the Mayflower?
I was just around the corner from the Mayflower by pure coincidence, because our office happens to be in the same block practically as the Mayflower Hotel. So all the atmospherics were playing, and the razzmatazz and the media circus, which I think maybe Monica Lewinsky was rather surprised about, that after she'd been absent from Washington for the best part of 4 months, the interest is still there, and it's maybe even heightened.
Mm-hmm. And what overall is the Independent's approach to dealing with the Senate impeachment trial?
We've actually been covering it in quite some detail, partly because our editors in London feel that whatever the theatricals surrounding it, it is actually a very important historical and constitutional event that deserves to be covered in a serious way. But, of course, the sex and politics aspect has a certain drawing power for British newspaper readers, so that's not inappropriate either.
If we were in a London newsstand, could we tell the difference between the tabloids and the Independent these days?
I hope you could. I hope we'd have a little more emphasis on the politics and the Constitution. We're also a rather larger paper.
Well, speaking of very significant issues in both Brazil right now and in Nigeria, there are major issues going on. In Brazil, Paulo Sotero of O Estado de Sao Paulo, you're dealing with your economy crashing. You're dealing with many people out of jobs and hunger. Are you also dealing with the Senate impeachment trial?
Yes, but in a more a measured way. We are interested in the story, obviously, because it involves the fate of the President of the United States. The story is less interesting now than it was initially because we all know that how it's going to end, that the President will remain in office, that this case, one way or the other, it's going to end with an acquittal of the President. And so I reported yesterday, as my British colleague did, about this latest development here. And I got some space for it for the first time in a week or so because we sort of got tired of the story. And as you mentioned, we have a much more important story going on that affect the lives of the Brazilian people right now. So we are covering both stories, but and we will give a lot of space when this thing finally comes to a close.
Dapo Olorunyomi of Tempo in the News in Nigeria. How are you looking at the Senate impeachment trial? Actually, President Clinton raised Nigeria in a State of the Union address, saying some of the most important elections are going on there. President Carter just left Nigeria. How are you looking at our country?
Well, actually, from many perspectives, one is the fact that, you know, we've just been through about two decades of military dictatorship. So the question of accountability had been a very strong one. How do you hold leaders accountable? So from this point of view, Nigerians are generally intrigued and interested in what is happening to the president of, you know, the most powerful country in the world. But that aside, there's also the dimension of the whole sleaze, the whole, you know, soap operatic dimension of this whole thing. And one issue really struck me, and a number of people have commented about this too, is the fact that, you know, on a world scale, you know, you find that, you know, there are changes that seem to be actually a function of American global culture in itself. That how come that Americans really think that politicians are like monks? You know, why would you expect to take a politician so serious as far as his moral life? And the fact that, you know, President Clinton is able to really do a great job, you know, for the economy, you know, for the society, it seems to really puzzle Nigerians why, you know, there's so much, you know, concern about getting him impeached.
Well, while we're on the subject of you coming from Nigeria, can I get a quick comment from you on what is happening in your country around the issue of elections, if you think they're significant, elections that couldn't be held, for example, in the South because of the massive resistance to oil corporations, so they just canceled the elections in some southern states?
We have just had a number of elections, state assembly and the governorship elections, but we couldn't have it in Bayelsa State. That's a state in the southeastern part of Nigeria that produces 40% of Nigerian oil. And this is a result of the fact that the youths in the area, the people in the area, particularly the Ijaw people are about the fourth largest ethnic nation in the country. And they have virtually issued an ultimatum to oil corporations in the area for years of environmental abuses and for lack of accountability to, you know, the community in which they've been really drilling oil. And they want them to leave. But as is always the case, you know, a coalition between oil multinational interests and the Nigerian military, they moved in and they've killed a number of people in the Ijaw area, and there's extreme tension in that area. So at the one hand, well, we are hoping that there will be a transition, you know, to civil rule come May 29th in Nigeria. It's also the fact that now we are seeing a convergence of business and military might that will derail that process, perhaps.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves. I do want to get one more quick comment for what's happening in Brazil and go back to Mary Dujewski on the connection between Tony Blair and President Clinton, a very close one, and the role that Tony Blair has played in helping out President Clinton in President Clinton's time of need. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, our guests from newspapers in Brazil, Nigeria, and Britain. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Our guest, Dapo Olorunyomi, reporter for Tempo and the News in Nigeria, Mary Dujewski, Washington correspondent for The Independent of London, and Paulo Sotero, Washington correspondent for O Estado de Sao Paulo in Brazil. We were talking on Saturday, Paulo Sotero, about I had just seen a news report on a Ford plant in Brazil. They had laid off thousands of workers, and so there was a massive protest there by the union, and they changed the logo, which is F-O-R-D, Ford, to F-O-M-E, which means hunger. Can you tell us what is happening in Brazil right now?
Well, we floated our currency that was before in a system of peg with the dollar. We floated the currency. There was a devaluation. There is the possibility of further devaluation that could bring a recession, a deep recession, with obviously unemployment. It's a very serious crisis. This president that we just reelected last October. Won the first time, was elected the first time, was reelected because he was able to implement a very successful program for taming inflation that has been a historic problem in Brazil. So we are in this moment when we are faced with the problem that we always had, which is to manage our public finances better. This is the crucial problem in Brazil. And if I might tell you how this influences my job here, for instance, the most important story I wrote recently, actually was published yesterday in my paper about the United States and had a lot of repercussion there. It has nothing to do with Monica, has nothing to do with impeachment, has to do with something that the United States does very well, which is how states here manage their public finances. 49 of the 50 states in the United States cannot run a deficit, a budget deficit. They are forbidden by law or constitutional clauses. So I wrote about this. I told that the budget surpluses of the states in the United States last year reached $31 billion. I try to explain, obviously it has a lot to do with the state of the economy here, but I try to explain that to the Brazilian public, that there is a way of doing management of public finances better than we do, and the article got a lot of positive responses, reactions, and I got a lot of emails yesterday saying, keep on doing this. This is what we want to hear about the United States, not the impeachment.
And Mary Dujewski, finally, on the issue of impeachment, Tony Blair, the Prime Minister of Britain, has bailed out President Clinton a number of times, flying to the United States at one of his lowest moments to hold a joint news conference with him to show that President Clinton can deal with international issues, foreign policy, national security. How does that play in Britain?
This time last year, which was actually when Tony Blair came to the U.S. and stood up on a platform with President Clinton and basically boosted his international authority. He sent the message worldwide that this man can still run a country, he is still respected worldwide. So to that extent, he did him a big favor. I think since then, partly because of the joint actions over Iraq and various other joint initiatives and statements through the UN, there started to be a degree of criticism in Britain about the closeness between Tony Blair and Bill Clinton, and particularly, you know, a little talk, a little bit of rumour, a little bit of speculation about maybe how Britain is trotting along too much like a little poodle behind the US, and maybe we've got something better to do, maybe more Eurocentric than biased towards America.
Didn't some legislators speak about President Clinton who was admonished for doing that?
Yes, there was one of the few female ministers in the UK actually criticised President Clinton and said that she thought he ought to resign over the Monica Lewinsky affair. And she was very quickly told that this was not government policy, this was nothing to do with Britain, and she should keep quiet.
You know, just interesting to see that relationship. When you look at the House prosecutors, many in this country, since the overwhelming polls show that the population doesn't want President Clinton removed, people wonder what fuels the House prosecutors and the Republicans. And the response often is, well, look at how Democrats often didn't understand the love that the people in this country had for President Reagan. You look at the close relationship between Blair and Clinton, and then you look back to the relationship that Margaret Thatcher had with President Reagan. Well, I want to thank you all very much for being with us. And we are going to, of course, continue to cover this issue. We'll be back on the Hill today for the Senate impeachment trial, covering whether or not the senators will be allowed to have a debate on the issue of dismissal of this trial or on the issue of subpoenaing witnesses. And we'll bring you more on this also on Democracy Now! Tomorrow. Our guests have been Mary Dajewski, Washington correspondent for The Independent of London, Paolo Sotero, Washington correspondent for O Estado de Sao Paulo, and Dapo Olorunjomi with Tempo and the News in Nigeria. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move on to our last issue today, which is the issue of Mexico. After a complex and often bizarre four-year trial, a Mexican judge last week convicted Raul Salinas, brother of ex-president Carlos Salinas, of ordering the 1994 assassination of a prominent politician and gave him a 50-year prison sentence with no possibility of parole. The stunning ruling and sentencing of Salinas represented a deviation from the usual impunity enjoyed by prominent and powerful politicians in Mexico, and it was viewed as the most important criminal verdict in modern times. Prosecutors had charged that Salinas was the intellectual author of the September 94 assassination of José Francisco, a rising star in the political party that governed Mexico for most of this century. Although some legal experts quickly praised the judge's decision, many also said that the case also exposed the justice system's chaos and disarray. Salinas was condemned mostly by hearsay evidence, much of it obtained from witnesses under torture. A new report by Human Rights Watch says that prosecutors and judges deserve much of the blame for human rights violations that occur in Mexico, including torture, which is routinely used to extract confessions. The verdict came at the start of Pope John Paul II's visit to Mexico, where he spoke on the excesses of capitalism and again criticized neoliberalism. He also told the Mexican church not to ignore the spiritual needs of the wealthy this days before he meets with President Clinton in St. Louis. Today is the Pope's last day in Mexico. We're joined right now by Joel Solomon, Research Director for the Americas for Human Rights Watch and author of a new report on Mexico called Systemic Injustice, Torture, Disappearances, and Extrajudicial Executions in Mexico. Also, Eric Olson is with us, a senior associate for Mexico from the Washington office on Latin America. Eric Olson, you've been following the trial of Raul Salinas very briefly. Can you tell us about the significance of this 50-year sentence?
Well, it's significant in that rarely has somebody so closely tied with a family that's been in power in Mexico been put on trial in such a public way and ultimately been put in jail for his involvement in a murder scheme and possibly other illicit enrichment. It's significant for that in that regard. It's also troubling because, as you pointed out in your introductory remarks, this has hardly been a triumph of the rule of law in Mexico. The case was fraught with problems from the outset. Several special prosecutors were forced to resign and left in disgrace because of their use of extra-legal means. And so it's a very partial victory, if you will.
How did it end up that he was prosecuted? I mean, you do rarely see high officials in the Mexican government, part of the pre-party, being gone after by that very same establishment.
Well, Raul Salinas, the brother of the president, was intertwined with the victim, José Francisco Ruiz Massieu, in numerous ways. They were business associates. Raul Salinas' sister had been married to José Francisco from years past, and so there was immediate suspicion and intrigue when the case occurred, when the murder occurred of José Francisco Ruiz. Then in the early stages of the investigation, the people directly involved for the murder referred to Raul Salinas on numerous occasions, and so suspicion quickly focused on him as a co-conspirator in this crime.
Joel Solomon, this report that you've just put out called Systemic Injustice, Torture, Disappearances, and Extrajudicial Executions in Mexico, it might be that the U.S. government, which continues to fully support the Mexican government, will say this proves the effectiveness, the efficiency, the honesty of the Mexican judiciary right now. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think Eric is right. If the goal of a justice system is to be able to go after high-ranking politicians or people very close to the inner circle of justice, of power, then this is a triumph of the justice system. But that's not the goal of a justice system. Any justice system needs to be able to prosecute crimes according to the rule of law without committing human rights violations and see that those who commit crimes are brought to justice. In that regard, Mexico's justice system remains deeply, deeply troubling. Over 2 years, we studied cases involving political figures, involving common crime and drugs, and found that prosecutors turn a blind eye toward abuses committed by police or soldiers, or they fabricate evidence, and judges don't show concern about these kinds of procedural irregularities or very troubling problems like torture and disappearance when they sentence alleged criminals.
When it comes to Mayans, when it comes to Native Indians in Mexico, what is the response of the judicial system? I know that the Pope raised the issue of respect for Indian rights yesterday, calling on Mexico to work toward a more just and equal society and to ensure respect for the rights of indigenous peoples.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mexico's justice system fails regarding human rights, regardless of the background of the person being tried. But when it comes to people who don't speak Spanish as a first language, much of the indigenous population of Mexico, these people face additional hurdles. In theory, the Mexico authorities are supposed to provide a translator, but in practice, often the translators are not provided or they really don't do a good job. So these people, the indigenous people of Mexico, face additional hurdles in addition to those that everyone else faces.
Can you talk about President Zedillo's role in the justice system and what he does around the issue of human rights violations?
Well, in recent years, the Zedillo administration, including the president himself, has increasingly talked about the importance of protecting human rights. And that's positive when it comes from the president, when it comes from the attorney general, when it comes from others in the government. Unfortunately, what we haven't seen is this rhetoric matched by action in specific cases designed to promote human rights. And in that sense, the government still appears to be afraid of engaging in the human rights debate in Mexico in any serious way. Mm-hmm.
In Colombia, we see the U.S. government complicity in supporting the human rights abusing military there. What about in Mexico and the level of U.S. support for the military of Mexico, which you document is notorious for human rights abuses?
Right. Well, the United States is training Mexican soldiers to engage in police-related or anti-narcotics-related activities. This is being done without attention to strengthening the civilian institutions in Mexico that should be able to carry out police-related activities, and that's very troubling. The United States aid directly to the Army, directly to units engaged in abuses, whether police or military, is relatively minimal, but troubling because the United States is encouraging Mexico to be the Mexican military to become much more involved in the fight on drugs.
In these last few minutes, I want to ask you each about recommendations you have for the situation in Mexico. Joel Solomon, in your report, Systemic Injustice, you list a series of recommendations.
Right. I think all three branches of government in Mexico need to take steps. The executive, the president, needs to match pro-human rights rhetoric with zero tolerance for human rights violations in specific cases, and the government needs to lay out a clear plan for combating human rights violations, starting with a very public, detailed diagnosis of what the problems are. The government minimizes human rights problems, so we need to start there. The justice system itself, the judges, could play a much more important role in promoting human rights by ensuring that judges do not accept evidence obtained through human rights violations. A lot more can be done in that regard.
Today is the Pope's last day, but he did address the issue of the Zapatistas, the pro-Indian rebels in Chiapas, many of them Indian themselves, Mayan Indians. He didn't discuss them on the trip, but on his flight to Mexico, asked by reporters about Chiapas, the Pope said a solution to tension in the region could only come when the rights of the original owners of the land were recognized, clearly referring to the Mayans. A last comment, Eric Olson from Washington Office on Latin America.
Well, I think that's right. I think until the issues of human rights, basic rights of indigenous people, and the rights of all Mexicans become the center piece of the negotiations, I think though the Chiapas conflict will remain, and other conflicts in other states that have emerged will continue to continue and be a real problem. So I think resolving the fundamental issues of the rights of indigenous people and the rights of Mexican people to land, to freedom from torture and abuse by the judicial system are absolutely at the center of finding peaceful negotiated solutions.
Thank you very much, Eric Olson of Washington Office on Latin America and Joel Solomon of Human Rights Watch for being with us. That does it for today's show. To get a copy, you can call 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Produced by Maria Carrion with help from Stephanie Donnie and Jeremy Scahill. Joe Gill engineered from the Washington studios of WPFW. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!